we trust. Charge we're not sure about.
On a day that saw the New York Stock Exchange down for a couple of hours and United Airlines grounded for pretty much most of the morning, well, no sweat, the In Tech We Trust podcast sails smoothly into episode 43. You are recording, right, Gabriel?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I just don't want technology to bring us to our knees like it has done other companies today. No sweat, though. So on this week's show, we've got Solid Fire's very own Gabriel Chapman. How goes it, Gabriel?
It goes well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good actually, yeah. And also joining us, formerly of EMC, now of Blue Box and IBM Company, Tyler Britton. Welcome to the show, Tyler.
Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. So, before we dive on into the news and stuff this week, does anybody actually have anything interesting to ease us into the show? Any cool stories or anything funny going down?
Oh, yeah. It's been a crazy week, that's all. We're having our annual SE summit where our own internal SEs show up as well as our partner SEs. So it's been a lot of work getting that up and running because we do a full sets of labs and a lot of great stuff. But it's awfully chaotic getting up and running and ready to go. So
cool.
Still a lot of fun, though.
So, Tyler, we're going to talk to you a little bit later about what's going on with your own personal career and stuff. But how's your last week been?
It's been crazy. So this is the this is day three with Blue Box. I'm out in Seattle right now. So it's been a bit of a whirlwind.
So this is day three, and what time is it there in Seattle right now? Is it like 3:10 or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 3:10.
And you've got time to, you know, step aside and do a bit of podcasting. That's pretty nice.
Yeah. Hey, for you guys, of course.
Yeah, I like it. You know what? This is episode 43, right? And I am an absolutely shocking podcaster. So I should have really given you a chance to introduce yourself, tell people how they can find you on Twitter and all that kind of stuff. So go on, Tyler. Just let's get a brief intro as to who you are and how we can reach out to you.
Sure. Thanks, Nigel. Yes, Tyler Britton. I am, as I just mentioned, day three at Blue Box, which is now an IBM company. As the technical marketing manager, working on all things tech marketing. And previous to, 4 days ago, I was an employee of EMC, working in tech marketing there, and then before that, a vSpecialist.
Okay, so does that mean you've jumped straight from EMC straight into Blue Box with, like, not even a day in between?
Yeah, I had last week, so we had a little bit of a break.
Okay.
And, you know, worked out with the holiday week too here in the States, and ready to get started.
Yeah, your treason or traitor day that you celebrate, yeah?
Yep.
No, happy July the 4th, gents. Well done. All right, so I tell you what, let's jump on into the tech news for this week. So I've got four items on the agenda, right? Two major downtime stories that are still relatively hot on the wires. First, I think there was talk of network-related issues grounding United Airlines flights earlier this morning. And then shortly after that, there was the New York Stock Exchange down due to, according to their Twitter feed at least, an internal technical issue. And when the second story broke about the New York Stock Exchange, there was quite a little bit of talk about, is this cyber terrorism or something like that? So I don't know, maybe we'll talk about that. Two other events, though, that I thought were worthy of note. Microsoft reportedly planning Azure price hikes across the globe and citing currency-related matters as the major reason behind that. I'm hoping we'll get a good old chance to talk about that. And finally, Cisco, this is a bit of a jab at them, but they seem to be following their major networking rival HP by investing in white box networking company, French-based SixWind. I don't think that's like a major move or anything, but I do wonder whether it's the sign of them making sure that they don't get caught off guard later on when white box networking starts eating through their major markets. Can we talk about the downtime stories at the moment, though? So, I mean, two really big downtime stories in one day, United Airlines and the New York Stock Exchange, just really showing us how reliant everyday life, right, is on technology. Should we expect to see stuff like that more and more and more going forward? And is it right to automatically assume, is this kind of cyber terrorism whenever it happens? Or should we just be thinking, you know what, most of the technology stack at a lot of these companies is maybe getting older and older and more difficult to manage. And IT staff are pushed harder than they've ever been before, and they're stressed more and they're underpaid more. Is this just to become the norm?
Maybe it was just a backhoe.
What's that?
Like a loader, like a So a lot of times, I've seen outages for specific places, and I'm no knowledge about what happened at the exchange, and I'm guaranteed they have multiple redundant systems. But somebody's doing some work on the sewer or something, and they hit a fiber optic line, and they knock entire town down or an entire set of buildings down. The interesting thing about the stock exchange being down is that none of the trading actually happens at the stock exchange in New York. It all happens in Mahway, New Jersey.
Okay.
And so it's interesting that, something happened that put not only took down NYIAX, but also took out the Wall Street Journal, the magazine group there as well. So, it's all speculation at this point. I mean, some of the technical or the financial blogs were speculating left and right about what possibly could have been the cause of it, and why it was down to begin with.
Okay, and was there anything interesting that they were speculating about?
It's all conspiracy theories.
Oh, I love stuff like that.
Yeah, if you go to zerohedge.com, I mean, that's probably the best place to go for speculative news around trading and around the financial markets.
Okay, I'll have to check that out. I'll put it in the podcast notes. You do remind me, though, Gabriel, in my last job, tell you what, anytime I walked into the office and there was somebody digging the road up outside of corporate HQ where I worked in London, it'd be like, oh, no, you know what? That's bad news for today. But quite often we'd have, we'd have a change advisory board meeting every week, but as part of that meeting, they'd be like, well, what are planned works going on around the data center and around the corporate headquarters? Because you're right when you say, anytime somebody like a utility company or whatever digs up the street outside, honestly, the number of times that they go through a fiber cable, it's just insane. We would sometimes, in fact, if there was any major digging work going on around the data center, we would do a proactive failover to our secondary data center of certain services, right? Just to mitigate any risks there. And, I imagine New York is exactly the same, but you get somewhere like New York or London or any metropolitan area, and they're forever digging the roads up, and they're forever going through cables and causing all kinds of havoc. It's absolutely, it's insane.
Yeah, and especially, as Gabriel mentioned there, where there's normally we see people trying to spread things out for availability and redundancy and those types of things, we end up seeing the opposite recently with the financial industry, just because, distance is time, and especially with high frequency trading and things like that, time is money. So you have these new data centers, you mentioned in Mahwah, New Jersey, mm-hmm. Where they're, hey, this stock exchange is going to move here. Well, guess what? So does, every large, financial trading firm moves there too. So now you start to concentrate some of those things where, one oopsie can end up being a pretty big oopsie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with so many of, the larger trading houses paying the premium to be co-located at the actual exchange itself, the must-read book is Flash Boys. It talks about, the birth of high-frequency trading, the birth of the race to the lowest latency possible to the exchanges, and how, some people will talk about traders being able to front-run the market in order to do price discovery to determine, what somebody wants to sell a stock for. Because if you know that, then you can make a few pennies or a few shavings of pennies on each trade. And if you do that enough times in the course of the day, you can make a significant amount of money. I mean, if you look at Goldman Sachs, who hasn't had a negative trading day in close to 3 years. So, they're doing something smart.
Yeah, I mean, I heard rumors a while ago, and I don't know whether it was true or not, but in some of these colo sites, they were talking about, a technical advantage having a shorter cabling run within the yep. building, once you came in and stuff like that. Talking, well, I don't know what they're talking, microseconds, I'm guessing there, as being some kind of advantage. It's just insane. So if you're outside of like New York or London or those kinds of places, let's say you're in a neighboring city, you got no chance, right? You need to be as close as possible. You know, I know as well, we used to get photographs occasionally when somebody had gone through our fiber cables and stuff to say, you know, look at what the contractor has done. And there'd be a you know, somebody's taken a photo on their mobile phone of the hole in the ground and the damaged fiber cable. But, you know, if you look closely at those photos, there's so much stuff underneath the roads in these towns. I mean, you know, and in places like London, you're risking hitting like an old World War II bomb and stuff occasionally sometimes, you know, but literally what's underneath the roads is crazy scary, you know, from a cabling perspective and stuff. We are, I used to think, you know, if you'd lift up the floor tile in a data center and it's like a rat's nest under there, well, as soon as you start digging into the road and anything, you know, to fix a water main or something, you risk taking somebody's business out by going through their fiber cable at the same time. Sheer madness.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that blows my mind along those lines is New York City, right there, adding a subway on the 2nd Avenue, which is obviously taking a long, long time. And you can imagine they're digging up the road and moving the stuff that's there out of the way to build a subway tunnel. It's
holy cow. Yeah, good luck with that. You know what, though? Just one last question on this. Do you think it's – this is like sheer speculation, and I don't expect anybody to know really anything about this, but – are all of these outages and things like that, do they tend to boil down to boring, mundane stuff like we just talked about? Or how often do you think, or you know what, here's a question actually, how at risk do you think we are of a major cyber attack? So it's, what is it? It's the 8th of July today. So we just we didn't celebrate yesterday, right? So yesterday was 7/7, which is quite a big date in the UK, 10 years after the London bombings, right? And, you know, there was a coordinated attempt there to bomb several strategic transportation locations, stuff like that. Are we at a significantly increased risk of something along the lines of that, but a cyber terrorism attack? So let's say, you know, it doesn't have to be a foreign government. It could be anybody wishing to wield political influence by coordinated set of attacks on strategic trading firms, technology companies, banks, things like that.
I think the bad actors involved would occur at governmental levels. And, you know, there is, you know, the DOD and DARPA and those three-letter agencies all have contingency plans in place, and not sure if they work or not, but they also have mitigation teams that analyze what the impact on, say, the power grid is. Or, I mean, if you really want to hurt America, you go after the financial markets, you know, mm-hmm. anything that can cause a delay, you know, or even in shipping manifests or, you know, the power grid and these different areas that affect traffic and day-to-day life. I think something that we're not so networked as a nation in terms of, you know, somebody wanted to go after the whole entire U.S., it would be very hard because they would have to go after all of these multiple disparate power grids, right, or all these different areas. I mean, you could affect air traffic control, but you're probably only going to be able to affect a certain region or portion of it. So, you know, the real damage that you're going to do is financial, and that's, I think, where cyber attacks would go after to really hurt the U.S. or any other major nation would be financial attacks that basically could bring markets down. Where if you look at on the opposite side of that, what the U.S. was suspected of doing with the – I forget the name of the worm, but the worm that affected the power – the centrifuge operations and power plant operations in Iran, where they basically got, you know, essentially root access and caused damage internally, that would be a much more it would be, you know, stronger governments with the ability to do something of a malware type of thing that can take out a certain system or a certain project that another country is working on.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing is if you think about a traditional attack, like a bomb or something like that, there's destruction, lives lost, and destruction that may take days, weeks, months, years to rebuild. Whereas, you know, something along the lines of, say, quote, taking down the New York Stock Exchange, you know, that's, what does it take them hours to days to bring it back up? It's more of like a denial of service, right, than it is destruction. I think what we're seeing is in those fronts that when it comes to state actors is things that are much more economically focused. Like you've seen some of the details of, you know, companies that are for industrial espionage, right? Losing plans and for solar panels. And then you see, you know, whether it's plants in China that are making them the same way. You know, there's even talk, if you look at some of the latest fighters coming out of the, you know, out of China, how much they resemble plans of fighters that just came out from the US and where they got access to those plans and those types of things. I think that's really been the traditional, like, hey, you know, you turn the TV and it turns out that all the, you know, whatever is down. I think it's more of, you know, more of those economic type actors.
Yeah. You know, one of the stories that I did read around the New York Stock Exchange did actually quote the FBI as saying that they were closely monitoring the situation. So I guess, you know, Gabriel, you mentioned all those three-letter government divisions and stuff. I guess they really do keep a close eye on stuff like this because, well, short-term and long-term, it is very important for the viability, well, not the viability of the nation, but the prosperity of the nation, I guess. So very interesting stuff.
Yeah, and to see it coincide at the same time that the Greece episode is happening in the Eurozone. You know, the crazy thing about hackers and whatnot is them, you know, fairly sophisticated attacks have come from very small groups of people. Look at the Lizard Squad hack that took it down. Xbox was done by two kids. You know, that one kid's 17 years old, and they just hit him with 50,000 counts of, or he got convicted of 50,000 counts of hacking. 50,300 based on that one attack on Microsoft. Because I think they charged him for every single thing he did was part of, you know, each individual attempt or each individual service was a single call. The funny thing about it is he only got 3 years in prison.
Well, he's only 17, isn't he? Give the kid a chance. You know, you don't want to ruin his life at such a young age.
Yeah, but that was a Christmas attack. I mean, that's like the day everybody got their Xbox and they're trying to get their Xbox online and the whole system is down for like 3 days.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit. Since you're talking about Microsoft there, there is talk that Microsoft is planning to increase its Azure prices. At first, there was talk about it being in Australia and in Europe. Microsoft have come back with a retort and what have you. I think it's a little bit unclear at the moment, but there is the potential talk of between 10 and 25% price increases for Azure-based services. Now, not only is 10 to 25% like mahoosive, okay, I've owned a budget in previous jobs in the past, and if my OPEX costs were to go up 10 to 25% over and above what I'd budgeted for a year, I personally would be in a lot of trouble, okay? But then I started thinking, right, you know, as infrastructure as a service and all that kind of thing effectively boils down to three players, Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, and a little bit of Google in there as well, okay? Are we at an increased risk of, number one, a price-fixing cartel? Now, I'm not making any accusations here. I'm just saying, are we at an increased risk of that, right? Because we're accustomed to it being a race to the bottom at the moment. Yeah, prices constantly going down, 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 down. Are they doing that to get us addicted to this stuff? And then, boom, at some point it's going to be, well, that's not feasible anymore, and they start creeping up. Right at the point where we've started putting primetime production services and the likes on there, or am I getting a bit carried away?
Well, I think it's one of those things is that I remember when, was it Microsoft that basically made OneDrive unlimited and someone had tweeted out or someone said, well, storage is officially free.
Yes. Yeah.
We're
done.
We're done with paying for storage. And you're like, well, wait a second. You know, this is one company is doing this for a, you know, probably a determinate period of time. It was like the same thing when Mozi used to be, you know, unlimited and all these unlimited services it's a financial model on their end, right? They're assuming the average person is only going to use a certain amount and that type of thing. It's not really, you know, unlimited. And I think I'm sure a piece of it is just Microsoft realizing that it's, you can't just keep dropping the price to and win on a pure price war. I think that's why they're looking to focus on a lot of the stuff out of, you know, pure infrastructure as a service. And I think you're right. I think that piece is getting really, commoditized and, you know, and kind of just a utility where, you know, there's even you get past them, you get to the DigitalOceans of the world, who also just got a B round of funding, where it's, hey, if you're just looking to spend some compute, it's going to be, you're going to have a good bit of options and it's going to be relatively cheap.
The race to bottom can only be sustained for so long. And, you know, Microsoft's in a position where, you know, they offer some pretty fairly unique services inside Azure. and they can pretty much do whatever they want with the pricing at that point. You know, the Office 365 and a lot of those products, I mean, there's a lot of companies using that technology. It's just, I guess it probably boils down to how big is the price increase, right? Is it, you know, is it 5%? Is it 25%? And, you know, I think you would see a lot of drop off if it was too obscene. But if it's, you know, 5 or 10%, most customers, you know, it's like, hey, it's cost of doing business.
It does, absolutely. Yeah, just it feels, I don't know. Look, I totally get that nobody likes prices going up, okay? And especially in the public cloud space, we are very accustomed to prices constantly going down. And I don't doubt that you're not wrong there. It can't last forever, right? But you do, they do sweeten you to get onto these platforms, right? And then you start building a business model around it and all that. And suddenly, and I don't know if I'm just being old-fashioned or what here, but they've got you hooked in then, haven't they? And you're not at their mercy, okay? But it's a pain to move away from them. And something like Office 365, right? There isn't really, at least as far as I'm aware, a viable alternative. So I don't know. They do seem to have us by the short and curlies almost here. I mean, I'm not on a downer on Microsoft here. Half of me was thinking as well, you know, this is probably a sign that Azure and some of their cloud-based services that they run are actually very, very viable and very good services. You know, you certainly can't hike the price up on something if it's crap and nobody wants to use it, right? This is probably a sign that, you know, Microsoft are doing pretty well there.
Well, I mean, it's the typical, you know, the drug dealer market plan, yeah. Right? You give somebody a saying? Taste and the first hit's free, right?
Yeah.
All the rest will cost you. And that model is fairly prevalent in the marketplace across a lot of different verticals and technology platforms. So it's, you know, it's up to the individual organizations to do the due diligence and walk in with their eyes full open saying, hey, there's a possibility that your prices are going to go up. My cable bill has never gone down.
Yeah.
It's just gone up. My cell phone bill has never gone down. It's just gone up. You know, it's life. It's a first world problem.
Do we have our heads in the sand then, expecting prices to remain so low on public cloud-based services? Is it like totally unrealistic? And should we be expecting Amazon Web Services and Google to follow suit here?
I mean, I would if they were offered a similar type of solution, right? Like so like let's say the alternative is the Google Document Suite, right?
Mm.
There's a lot of companies that use that as their primary mechanism for doing commerce and business and creating content. We use it SolidFire, right? We use Google Docs. And, you know, it's definitely cheaper than, Office 365 in many respects. So, you know, if Amazon or if Google or if those guys have a similar like offering that they can provide a customer base and they can look at the analytics of it and say, hey, maybe we can keep ours cheaper than Microsoft and capture that market that could shift to us. Or we can raise prices just like everybody else does. So you look at the airlines are similar. You know, one airline drops their price. You don't ever see usually one airline drop its prices drastically. What you do is see all of them raise their rates at the same time. So I would probably kind of think in these kind of oligopoly type situations that you would see them go up as well. Unless they want to carve out a bigger piece of the market. Similar situation, look at what T-Mobile has done in the cell phone space by offering all you can eat plans at like, you know, some horribly low rate, like, you know, 5 phone lines for $100. You know, I pay more than $100 just for my own line.
Ouch.
And it's a way to garner more customer base when your business model is to get all, you know, as many people as you can on your services.
Yeah, there's still and to Nigel, your earlier point here, it could be at some point there's got to be a get well plan, right? The old, hey, we're going to lose money on these initial people to get them on board, but we'll make it up in volume, right? Doesn't exactly work. At some point it has to be back in the black. But I am still surprised by the timing, considering we saw our first look at AWS's financials I guess that was about a quarter ago. Right. And their margins were pretty healthy at the prices they were at. So I would have to assume, you know, Microsoft could at least be in the ballpark there. Even if they're not operating as efficiently as AWS, you would assume they're close. And to have to make a price increase where you know, the market may not look favorably on it, was surprising to me.
Yeah, you know, and in some areas, they're still playing catch up to AWS as well, aren't they? So you'd expect them to be wanting to remain as lean as possible and as price competitive as possible while they attempt to make up ground. I just want to back up a little bit to, I think, something that you said there, Gabriel, about at SolidFire, you use Google Docs. You know, I can think of two or three customers of mine that are startups that use Google Docs as well. But I can't think of anybody that I know in that kind of startup-y type space that uses Office 365. But, okay, thinking back to some of the companies I used to work for, like some of the enterprises and typical corporations, they're the kind of Office 365 customers. So are we going to be getting to the point where Office 365 is for existing enterprises and traditional companies and what have you, and the likes of Google Docs and what have you, because the cost model is very, very different, that all of the kind of startups and young new companies, web-based companies and what have you, are all going with things like Google Docs?
I think it comes back to kind of what you're comfortable with. Back when I was a customer, we ran Microsoft Office and all those kind of things, and Exchange 5.5 and moved through the years. When you started looking at the other end, I remember one of the things customers were looking at was actually a virtual desktops. So they said, like, you know, these Microsoft licenses, hey, we're doing a lot more stuff with web browsers. We could do that, you know, hey, we can do Firefox on Linux or something like that. Can't we figure out a way to do this, you know, without Office? And it was just like, that was the one piece that was a deal breaker, was Office. So then, you know, if you look at that now, is you get people that are coming up, you know, college, you know, first job, startups, kid, they're using Gmail, using Google Docs. So it's something they're comfortable with. So they don't even miss the Office suite. Whereas I think it's, you know, a more established company. There's people that, you know, I've had customers switch to Google Apps, and, you know, some of the employees really struggled with the, well, where's this feature? Where's that feature that they were just used to with the Office suite.
I'll tell you right now, I loathe Gmail.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm with you there.
It's like, the search functionality, I mean, we were having this discussion yesterday too, me and a couple other people, and I'm like, nobody, you know, they don't build features that customers want, they build features that they want you to use.
Yes.
And so if you're not doing mail the Google way, then you're wrong. And I'm like, dude, I just want to be able to sort based on who, and instead of a search bar where I have to type in someone's name, I want to be able to sort my mail any number of dozen of ways that just does not exist. So I end up using the Outlook,
right, yeah.
The Outlook integration that basically does a sync between my Gmail and my Outlook, because I like the way, and you know, maybe I'm one of those get off my lawn types now, but you know, you get accustomed to doing work in a certain way, and you're much more effective without having to relearn something else that somebody has voiced in on you. And I think that's probably why larger enterprises we'll stick with Office 365 and not make a transition to something like Google Apps.
But are we at the long tail of something like Microsoft Office yet then? Or do you think it's still got a long life ahead of it?
Oh, it's got an awful long life ahead of it. You're not going to see the law firms switching to Google. And there are entire industries where it's just that is how business is done. And, you know, the install base is so large, and it's still, you know, it's going to come on every PC as a free trial for 90 days and, you know, all of that stuff.
Well, I think one of the biggest barriers to it was, you know, the cost of, you know, you say I bought a PC, you know, at Best Buy. Now I got to drop $500 to get the Office suite. Let me see if there's something else I can do. Whereas, yes. Hey, you can pay a monthly fee. You're going to get every new version. We're going to give you, you know, for your personal mail, you can even get a full blown, you know, Exchange account, all that kind of deal. I think that's smart. I think what's going to happen as, you know, I think we're at the long tail of the, you can only run this stuff in-house. I mean, even to the law firms and stuff, you know, I had law firms that said, you know, they had stuff that was in contracts with their clients that said things like they couldn't use Wi-Fi when they worked on their account. So literally people that worked at the law firm, if they started working on this one account, they would have to flip the Wi-Fi switch off on their laptop, because the customer dictated that. But I think as people get, you know, companies get much more IT savvy and about what's safe and what's not. And you know, I have to kind of agree with, you know, with Simon Wardley was saying the other day about, hey, you know, if you're worried about your stuff being stored in Gmail, you think you have a better security staff working for your company than Google does, you're probably you're probably wrong. So I think companies will get over that piece of it. And then I think, to Gabriel's point, I think though that's where Office 365 is really smart. And I think that will be the, you know, the go for. I think you'll see less and less on-prem Exchange servers, but I think Microsoft Office and Exchange as a whole will live on through 365.
And if you look at so much, I mean, as a services industry, so much of the things that we consume today are now pay per month. You know, my Spotify account, my Netflix account, the entertainment aspects are there, as well as now productivity. So, you know, I pay for Asana, I pay for Evernote and all of these other things that are, you know, the cost adds up. I mean, I probably pay more instead of buying these products, a lot of these things, it's like, you know, they have this ongoing residual annuity revenue stream. That's it's a great business model. If you can find a platform or a service that is going to get millions of people to use it and pony up 10 bucks every month, because nobody blinks an eye at 10 bucks.
I mean, it's totally that death of a thousand cuts, right? I went through a similar exercise. Just, you know, you look through your credit card bill and you're like, where did I spend all this money? There, and you're looking for those big purchases. And you start to be like, okay, well, it's XM Radio, all right. Like you said, Evernote, oh yeah, there's that Pandora, Spotify. Mm-hmm, yeah. Netflix. Oh, there's this. Oh, MLB.TV. And you just start going through them all and they're like, yeah, it's $5 here, $10 here. And then you add it all up and you're like, wow, I'm spending hundreds of dollars a month on these $5 to $10 a month things.
And if you don't go back through your credit card statements and look at those things, there are things you signed up for that you forgot about that you've been being charged for years. Like an e-fax account that my wife used for business a couple of years ago and hasn't used in probably 3 years at 16 bucks a month. And I'm like, my Lord.
Let's pivot slightly then. So I mentioned that Cisco are making some investments in a white box switching company called Sixwind. I don't really want to talk too much about that, but I do have a question around white box networking in general, right? I see at some point in the future the likes of Cisco and people starting to bleed business out to white box switching type companies and new networking models and things like that, you know. They're certainly not in the long tail of their major products or anything like that. But how far away do you think that kind of, you know, how far away do you think it is when white box networking starts having a major impact on Cisco's bottom line?
I think we're closer than we think, and closer than even Cisco thinks. You know, as we move, you know, to some amounts of consolidation, while things do move to, you know, if you don't think Amazon's using white box switching, if you don't think, you know, some of these big public clouds aren't using white box switching, you're missing out. So, you know, as they start to move there, it's going to be I think there's going to be a move across the market to just say like, hey, I want switches that are fast and cheap, and that's all I really care about, right? And it's hard to compete with Moore's Law when it comes to building ASICs. I mean, we saw that in all sorts of technology, even stuff as basic as, I remember when Data Domain was in their early days, and they said, oh, we're not doing post-process, we're not doing custom ASIC chips, we're just doing this with CPUs. Like, huh, how's that going to work? And they're like, well, we're just going to ride Moore's Law. And they did, you know, very successfully, and they have plenty of CPU and just keep getting faster and faster. So I think that model is going to be here much more quickly than we think with switching.
I think that there is a swath of customers out there today that have already started to make the transition. And then there's the enterprise where the risk of going white box is too high still. So, but if you look in the service provider market, the hyperscale market, those groups are already transitioning to that white box model. I mean, if you look at the things that Facebook built and others, they've built the kind of switching infrastructures to meet their specific needs because they have people who can do it. But your general enterprise customer, they don't necessarily have the programming staff on site to manipulate the white box switches to that extent. They're still going to have to go and do the hybrid approach model where they buy ports and then they buy software and they merge the two and make something work.
So do you think it's very similar to the kind of, OpenStack discussions that we've been having forever, right? Where I think, Gabriel, you've talked about this kind of pyramid of different types of customers where there's whatever it is, like the 10%, maybe 15% of, I don't know, like the Walmart labs and people like that, where they've got the kind of on-staff skills that can deploy OpenStack. You know, they can clone it straight from GitHub and build it themselves. Are they the same kind of people that you're talking about there that are already starting to pick up on white box networking?
I mean, I think that group already loves OpenFlow and those. I mean, uh-huh. They've already made those transitions to those where they can, right? And they don't, you know, I doubt many of them would make a regret going that direction. You know, it's something I like to ask when I go to conferences and shows, but my focus tends to be more around the storage and compute side than the networking side. So I haven't really sat down and talked at depth with networking people. I know 2 years ago that Stephen Foskett had done a software-defined data center event in Silicon Valley that was heavily based on software-defined networking. And, you know, there was 150 people in the room, and they were, you know, lots of people were raising their hands then even about looking at going software-defined networking on white box switches. But, you know, I would expect to see that in the Valley. If you did that in Tulsa, Oklahoma, it might be a different, you know, may see one hand.
Do you think we're ever going to get to the point then where these traditional lumbering enterprises, right, that are going to be buying Cisco forever and, now I'm not picking on Cisco, but, you know, EMC storage forever and stuff like that, where we'll get to a point where from both a price competitive perspective and an infrastructure agility perspective, where they're just not going to be able to compete with the folks that have been a little bit braver and have gone down the software-defined this and software-defined that route? Or do you think it's going to eventually balance out and, you know, you'll still be able to run a viable business on custom Cisco and EMC and Hitachi and all that kind of stuff versus a company that's running everything on white box with, you know, funky software written on the top of it that's all open source? Are they going to be neck and neck and you're still going to be able to compete on a level playing field? Or will we get to the point where, you know, the software-defined stuff for all running on just general-purpose Intel is going to be the one and only way?
I think you're starting to see the larger companies struggle in their messaging against that market. I mean, right now, they're, you know, you look at EMC, it's what, $21 billion in annual revenue or something.
And they're still doing well.
It's not going away, right? I mean, the HP, Dell, IBM, I mean, they all still have large customer install bases. And, you know, like I said, I always harp on it, but going back to risk aversion, for the companies that are more cutting edge and have the capabilities of knowing, you know, the kind of companies you go to do it where they're the smartest people in the room and they can do it themselves, they will. But that's a very small select segment of customers at this current place. And I don't see that that's going to change in the next 3 to 5 years too drastically. You know, I think overall, if you look at the industry, I mean, if you look at the state of storage, you know, this trend, you know, newer technologies are coming on board. We've seen this kind of, you know, market disruption at this rapid of a pace in some time. It's affecting all three tiers. I mean, there's stuff, you know, under NDA, there's things I've seen that I'm going, oh my God, that changes everything for a vast swath of workloads. Yeah, that's going to be a big deal, and it's going to really hit hard with some of these other organizations. And then you look and see what those organizations that see the same roadmaps start to do. They pay $1 billion for somebody like DSSD who didn't have a customer.
Yeah, I think it's, to me, the biggest change has been is there's definitely that small percentage of people that have all the, you know, brightest of the bright, and they're using all open source tools, doing it all themselves. But I don't think that's the real value. And I think enterprises for a while looked at that and said, well, we need to do that. And then when they looked at the cost of doing that themselves, you know, the old free like a puppy kind of, you know, kind of thing with open source where it's like, oh, well, it's all free. And I think what their customers are getting mature enough with open source to realize, the real value is commoditizing solved problems, right? So 20 years ago, if you were looking at a storage array from an EMC and an IBM, you know, both teams would show you all sorts of R&D and look at, we'll show you this chip fab and this custom ASICs we came up and here's why it's 10% faster. And, you know, they would impress you with how proprietary it was and how smart they were to come up with it. Whereas I feel like now the customers are starting to realize, like, I don't want all that proprietary stuff. And they actually are, you know, attracted to, hey, look, here's this company that, you know, here's a new storage array, for example, and it's using a common Linux kernel that a lot of the new storage array vendors use. They're using off the shelf x86 servers, and customers don't see that as a negative. They see it as a real positive because that company is spending its time on not solving problems, like figuring out how to control, build disk drive controllers, but how to, you know, fix the problems that they have and focusing on real value added stuff. And to me, that's what's really changing. Will EMC and Cisco and things like that completely go away? I'm sure some will, but, you know, if you think about Cisco, I could easily see a future, you know, 5 years from now where Cisco has a line of white box switches and they are providing stuff like ACI as software only. And they're even supplying it on other white box switch manufacturer switches because, you know, what they may be able to do there from a QoS perspective and thing may be the part that's really attractive to the customer base. And they don't really want to pay for someone to do custom, you know, ASICs for switch ports because they don't care. So I think that's really the change we're seeing. I mean, you're seeing with EMC with stuff like, you know, with Scale.io and ECS where they're doing more things, you know, in a more open manner. Like they did with Viper, I think that's just the way the market's going to go. So will some of these companies, you know, up and disappear? I'm sure some will move too slow and not make it, and some will. I mean, for example, you look at IBM. I mean, how long has IBM been around? I feel like every time we look at them, like, well, they're not going to be able to make this turn. You know, they do. There's IBM Global Services and things like that. So some of these larger companies, they have enough of a big enough war chest that they can take a little bit longer to figure it out.
Now, some really good points there, Tyler. We're running a bit long now, so let's just switch it over to, I've got three things here on business news before we can then talk to you, Tyler, about what's going on over at Blue Box, yeah? So in business news, okay, yeah, so EMC is selling its Syncplicity Dropbox ripoff to Skytel Capital. Don't know if that's just another example of an enterprise infrastructure type company having an unsuccessful foray into consumer markets. I don't know. This is a good one, though. XIO, surely one of the never was storage companies that literally just refuses to die quickly or gracefully. Why do they even still exist? I don't know. Anyway, they've hired their 10th CEO in 14 years, according to the Register. And one other thing, Facebook has announced plans for another wind-powered data center, this one in Clay County, Texas, 200-megawatt facility, which I'm assuming as long as the wind is blowing hard enough, will be 100% wind-powered. I don't know what happens when the wind stops blowing. Maybe everybody in the local area has to turn the kettles off. You guys find any of those stories interesting, worthy of discussion?
Well, the Syncplicity one's interesting to me because, you know, EMC has gone into the consumer market before with Mozy and iOmega.
Oh, yeah.
Syncplicity, I think, was a little different because it wasn't targeted at the general user. It was more sold to enterprises. Hey, your users like Dropbox, but you want some more enterprise-y type features. Check this out. I think the challenge there is really, to me, tools like that. So I obviously use Syncplicity at EMC. I use Dropbox, Google Drive, all those things. To me, it's where the integrations happen is what makes those things useful because they're pretty commoditized. It's the fact that everything I want to use plugs into Dropbox APIs. I want to use 1Password, I can plug it into Dropbox. Oh, I want to use this email client, I can automatically load things into Dropbox. And I think that's one of the areas where they're kind of stuck there because, you know, the difference between making things more open and consumery, which the, you know, users wanted, and make things more enterprise-y, if you will, to sell to the IT teams. And I think it's just, you know, a confirmation of consumerization of IT and the IT is out of the dictating business and they're into the order-taking business from their users.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, actually. I think that's really well put. They're out of the dictating and into the order-taking. Really good point. I've got a question for you, Gabriel, around the XIO thing, right? Obviously, you're at SolidFire at the moment. Do you ever come up against XIO? Because they've got an all-flash product these days. Do you ever come up against them? And shame on you, have you ever lost out to them?
I saw one once.
Oh, yeah?
I saw one once.
Have you got photographic evidence? Because I don't believe you.
It's like Bigfoot. It's a little blurry.
No, I mean, you know, I've seen them. I've seen them over the years at trade shows. I've seen them at some partner events where the XIO partners were selling their technology and their solution. And, you know, if you look at it on its face, it looks like compelling. I mean, they have a very good SMB3 story with Microsoft, going after a market that a lot of people really don't go after. And so that kind of differentiates them from what I understand. But in terms of them being competitive in the space, if you've had 10 CEOs in 14 years, you've lacked continuity and messaging and coherence. And it just means that, you know, they must be very frugal and very good with their money and must have not a large organization, I would think, if, you know, they've been around that long and not seen a legitimate exit or acquisition.
Well, is Seagate still pumping money into them? I know they were for a while because they were reliant on Seagate's drive technology specifically.
I think so, but I wouldn't want to be quoted on that. But yes, I think so.
Well, Oracle pumped a lot of money into Pillar and then eventually bought it.
Yeah.
They were probably the only people that bought it.
In fact, I don't think they even bought it technically.
Yeah, I think they just called in their note.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so it's I wanted to look it up on Crunchbase to see what, you know, because it's I think they had a few different listings in there. Yeah, I didn't see currency and numbers. I saw one currency number in there for a $2 million number.
Pocket change.
A $2 million A round. Back in 2013, so I don't know what it says to what they were before. It just seems not very well noted on. So,
okay, let's shift on then. It's boring me. Something far more interesting. Let's talk about you a little bit now then, Tyler. So I've got a few questions for you here, right? First up, right, describe yourself, and I don't mean like how tall you are and stuff like that. And you know what? I don't even mean who you work for right now. I'm interested in like, what kind of person are you? Because I want to know what drove you to Blue Box in the end, okay? And what took you away from EMC. So, you know, at your heart, who or what are you, Tyler?
Sure. I would say I'm probably like a lot of tech people. I'm a tinkerer. I like to, take some screws out of the case and see how it works inside and really understand things. You know, just saying because I said so or because that's the way it works isn't a good answer for me.
Oh, yeah.
And then I like, once I figure those things out, being able to explain them, seeing that light bulb go off on someone else's face, like, I totally get how that works. Being able to leave a meeting with someone and then feeling like it was a learning experience more than it was, an information sharing more than it was, hey, I talked at you for a while and said some buzzwords.
Cool. Hey, so you were at EMC for about 5 years, is that right?
Yep.
So what took you to EMC, or what appealed to you about EMC in the first place then?
It was interesting. So before that, I was working for a partner for a number of years, for about 4 or 5 years, mainly HP and NetApp on the storage side and doing VMware type stuff. And then, you know, this EMC opportunity came up with to go work for Chad and the vSpecialists, and you know, I didn't really know that much about it because I didn't know much about EMC at the time, besides obviously, the big player in the storage market. So this opportunity came up, and because it wasn't just storage, it was, hey, it's virtualization, it's storage, it's networking. Because originally when I got started in IT, I heavily focused on Cisco networking. So I said, hey, this will be really, really interesting to me where they all come together. So it was opened up a whole new world to me of EMC and what an interesting company it is and just a lot of cool and interesting people doing cool things, which I think a lot of technology companies have. But it's, when you don't see inside of a company, you just, you have assumptions. And I think a lot of my assumptions were blown away pretty quickly at EMC.
So do you have a particular assumption that you can tell us about that was blown away, or?
From what the NetApp team had told me, most people had horns and a tail, and they parked their pitchforks in the back. And I think there was this concept, which I think is, was earned at some point in time of, EMC, this incredibly hard charging sales centric company, you know, step over your mother to get a sale kind of approach. And while there's always people, and I think that's more of a personality thing, I didn't get that as an overall culture of the company. Right? There was a lot of people working on interesting things and some cool technology stuff because they were trying to help customers. And, you know, and I think that's the biggest thing. The idea that EMC was, you know, the sale came first, but, and really in most cases, the customer came first, which was good to see.
Cool. So 5 years at EMC, obviously something made you say, okay, no more EMC for me. Was that because you were getting itchy feet? Were you looking for something else, or did this blue box thing come from the left field?
I would say it was mainly from the left field. I mean, I think, you know, I'd been watching the blue box guys pretty closely along with some other companies in the space and just thought they had a really interesting approach to what they were doing with OpenStack. And I assumed after the IBM acquisition that, you know, that was kind of be, you know, like a lot of these small OpenStack startups just kind of like disappear into the ether of the larger company. And, you know, talking to Blue Box and IBM and seeing what they're doing, and that IBM's kind of, you know, pushing them forward and taking what they've been doing pretty successfully to market was really exciting.
Go on then. What are they doing?
So, you know, to kind of an earlier comment about OpenStack, right? It's you can't just, you know, there's no OpenStack DVD that comes in the mail and you pop in your servers and push the button and there's this magic cloud in it. I mean, honestly, you know, VMware is pretty easy, but there's still, you know, there's a reason they VCDXs are hard to get, right? There's always some level of expertise that needs to go into it. And yes, a lot of companies don't have that expertise to do the OpenStack thing, but they're really attracted to it because they like the concept, right? A piece of it is a cost structure, but a lot of it has to do with these really open APIs. If I want to use, you know, let's say I want to use a CI tool or something like that, well, they already support the OpenStack APIs. And there's all these options for this. So they want that, but they can't operate it. And in a lot of cases, they don't want to operate it either. Just like we were talking about earlier with email, you know, they're fine handing it off to Microsoft to run it. So what Bluebox is doing is they're offering OpenStack private clouds managed by Bluebox, both in their, you know, where they started dedicated clouds in their data centers and their colos, as well as local in customer data centers as well.
Hey, so they were bought or acquired by IBM. How many Bluebox employees are there, do you know?
Not off the top of my head. I want to say somewhere between 50 and 100.
Oh, that's not okay. Does it feel like a startup then? Like, is it totally, I mean, you've been there 3 days, right? 2.5 days. You know, is it totally different to the EMC experience yet?
Yeah, well, to me, it's interesting is I think a lot of the people have that, you know, it's been a startup, you know, they're a little older startup, right? Blue Box as a company has been around, I think, since the early 2000s, doing more in the managed hosting space too. So that it still has that startup feel to it. And I think, you know, coming to figuring out, you know, with the IBM team and, you know, having people from IBM here as well, kind of working through the process as we go. How do we integrate? How do we, you know, figure those things out? It's interesting to me having come from, you know, a large company, not as big as IBM, but big enough to, you know with some of those big company things of, you know, how payroll gets processed and, you know, all those back end big company systems you have to deal with. So it's an interesting time from that perspective.
Cool. Hey, I don't know if this is a bad question to ask. It sounds like, are they very similar to, do you know, Platform 9?
Sure, yeah. A good friend of mine, Ken Hoy, just went over to Platform 9.
Right, yeah.
Not too long ago. I think the biggest difference is Platform 9 is kind of focusing on the, from like I said, what I can gather a couple days in, Platform 9 is focusing on that management layer, that OpenStack layer, and kind of the customers bringing the compute from the hypervisor on down. Whereas with Blue Box, they're handling the whole thing operationally from end to end. So you just basically a consumer of the OpenStack environment versus you're not operating any piece of it.
Cool. I'm dead keen for OpenStack to succeed, right? And I haven't quite figured out in my own head how I think it's going to succeed. I had a brief conversation with Ken on Twitter yesterday, maybe the day before, about what's going on at Platform 9 and what have you. This does sound very similar. Appreciate, you know, slight differences and things. But I kind of started to wonder, maybe this kind of a model is how it can work for enterprises and people like that going forward. Whereas always in the past, I've been like, you know what, the technology behind OpenStack and the ethos and the idea behind it, I love that, right? But I just couldn't see a route that it could take where it could become viable in the long term. And, you know, somebody like a Blue Box and a Platform 9 and people like that, I'm starting to wonder, yeah, maybe there's something in that. I don't. Do you have any thoughts on that, Gabriel, actually? Because I know you're fairly au fait with OpenStack, you know, not down in, not the nitty-gritty.
The way I look at it is the success of OpenStack has already happened, right? I mean, it is a platform that's gaining traction across the spectrum, across a wide spectrum. So in terms of, you know, you can't just think of OpenStack as a product. It is a loose collection of projects that you can enable and push forward in lieu of pay-for type platforms that are out there. Where people are making money with OpenStack is MetaCloud and Blue Box and others who are approaching that from that managed service portion of it. Because I think there's a lot of people who want OpenStack who just don't have the time or expertise to get it up and running. It is not simple. It is not, you know, here's my executable, here's my DVD with all my stuff on it, and I deploy it, and I follow this guide, and there's, you know, because it is so highly customizable, you need true, you know, Nick's nerds in there who really understand this stuff. And that's where I see the most success for OpenStack deployments is in organizations where, you know, they've started out as hardcore Linux shops and have, this is the natural transition for them to build cloud services, not to build it on VMware, is to build it on KVM and manage it with, you know,
the command line.
Yes. So that's where I see it successful. And I think that the enterprises that want to do that, like I said, that want the agility of Amazon, but they want it in-house and under their control, that's where they go to a managed OpenStack environment that gets them up and running, gives them it's a band-aid or it's a bridge to get them to that point eventually where OpenStack matures enough to where they can get that, you know, installer type OpenStack implementation up and running. And I think you're seeing a lot of consolidation in the OpenStack marketplace around larger organizations like Cisco and HP and others, because they see the potential for revenue down the road if they start to do these things now, start to integrate and offer it into their larger customer bases. It allows them to pivot into an alternative revenue stream instead of get bypassed by it completely. You know, for me, you know, Jesse wrote a really interesting blog post the other day, you know, talking about, you know, some of the myths involved in OpenStack and success. And it was very, very much a Blue Box centric post. But, you know, there's a lot of truth that rang into that. This is an area I come in contact with on a daily basis. So for me, my version of the truth is a lot different than others who probably don't.
Yeah, and I think to me it goes back to that earlier, you know, like I said earlier, as far as with how companies are embracing open source, right? It's not, hey, I can't wait to the point where I can do git clone from GitHub and type a command and it's going to set up my whole OpenStack environment. It's a component that companies are using to build their tools with it, whether you're, you know, Blue Box, Platform 9, Mirantis, HP, Cisco, whoever. The advantage to the customer is you have these companies that are now collaborating on solved problems, right? How are we going to manage volume creation? Well, we're all working together on this Cinder thing, so that way the storage vendors don't have to figure out 50 different things to support. They can support this one thing, and then we can, you know, consume that. You know, and on and on down the line. So those individual vendors can work on the things that they think and their customers think are the valuable parts. So the Platform 9s and MetaClouds and Blue Boxes of the world can focus on things like how do we do in-place upgrades seamless to the customer, right? Whereas an HP may want to focus on, you know, how they can integrate their public cloud and their private cloud, you know, much more seamlessly for customers. So, I mean, if you think about, you know, back a decade ago, if you have a Cisco and a VMware and say even a Microsoft, you know, with, you know, buildings full of engineers basically working on the exact same problems, I think that's where the power of open source comes in. I think that's what you're seeing with OpenStack is, you know, and I think that's where you get you talk to people, then they'll say, oh, OpenStack, is it ready for prime time or it's not ready yet? Because that, you know, to Gabriel's point, they're coming from that mindset of when it's ready for me to just to run it myself, whereas there's all these companies, you know, the CERNs and Walmarts and Comcast of the world that are doing it that way. But there's plenty that are successful with distributions and companies like Blue Box, where they're getting that value prop of, hey, here's this open API, this easy cloud for me to use. And then, you know, in the case of a Blue Box, you also can have some of those public cloud like models around, you know, around usage. So you can add and remove nodes from your private cloud on a month to month basis.
Cool. Very interesting, guys. But we are running long on the show now. So any final comments?
The only thing I would say right now is, like I said, it's only 3 days in, but super excited for a lot of the stuff we have up and coming for the rest of the year, especially Tokyo. So we're working pretty fast and furious to get things together for Tokyo. So excited to...
So what is Tokyo, Tyler?
The next OpenStack Summit for the fall is in Tokyo is the next one, then Austin, I think, and then Barcelona. But we're... This will be our first OpenStack Summit as part of the IBM team.
Very cool. Well, thanks for being on the show, Tyler. Really appreciate all of your input. Thanks as well, Gabriel.
No worries.
Thanks for having me, guys.
No worries.
No worries. See you in Tokyo.
Absolutely.